Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 22nd of April. Before we talk about our topic, and an important one it is, the first hour, may I remind you, as if you needed reminding, today is the Pennsylvania primary, and tonight at 8 o'clock you are invited to join us for special election coverage of the Pennsylvania primaries. NPR's Robert Siegel, Melissa Block will be hosting a one-hour special covering the results from Pennsylvania and also looking ahead to North Carolina and Indiana. And then more analysis tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock with Joy Cardine. At 9 o'clock, we'll have Sander Van Oker with us. And in the afternoon with Ben Marins at 4 o'clock on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So all of that is coming up. We will cover that very thoroughly. A New York Times article on April 15 in the science section caught our attention, titled, "Who Are We? Coming of Age on Antidepressants." And the psychiatrist who wrote the article talks about his patient, Julie, who said that she had grown up on medication. She didn't have a sense of who she really was without it. At the age of 31, she'd been on one antidepressant or another nearly continuously since she was 14. And there was little question that she had very serious depression and had survived several suicide attempts. She credited the medication with saving her life. Her experience is far from unique since the emergence in the late 1980s. Prozac and Zoloft have become some of the most widely prescribed drugs in the world for depressed teenagers as well as adults. Still, the author asks, what do we know about the effects of, say, 15 to 20 years of antidepressant drug treatment that begins in adolescence or in childhood? And the answer is not enough. Dr. Richard Friedman is our guest. He is a professor of psychiatry and director of the Psychopharmacology Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. He specializes in anxiety and mood disorders and has expertise in psychopharmacology and refractory depression. He's also actively involved in clinical research of mood disorders, and we are welcoming here Dr. Friedman to the program for the hour to talk about these important issues. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Dr. Friedman. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
And Julie had presented to you an issue that you hadn't seriously considered before, how the drug, because she'd been taking them for so long, may have affected her psychological development and core identity. How do you answer that?
Well, it's a tough question. And actually, it amazed me that I hadn't thought of it before. But then again, neither had any of my colleagues. You know, we treat people all the time with these drugs. And she just kind of popped the question to me one day and said, you know, I've been on these drugs for such a long time. And she had no notion of herself outside of her, you know, treatment with these antidepressants. The answer to the question, frankly, was we don't really know. Mm-hmm. You know, we assume that, you know, using the drugs to treat depression not only makes the depression better, but it stops it from coming back, and that's clear. We know that from many, many studies. So that's the good side of things. But the answer to her question is, you know, what has the effect of being on these antidepressants had, if any, really, on my development as a person? And I couldn't answer her question. It was kind of tantalizing, which is why I thought about it and wrote that piece.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, we know a lot about the course of untreated depression.
Right.
And what is that?
Well, it's not good in the sense that, you know, we know the people who are depressed have a very high risk of suicide, and, you know, anywhere from 2% to 12% of people who have the illness, major depression, will kill themselves in their lifetime. Mm. And, you know, that's much, much, much higher than in the general population, where the risk of suicide is about 10 to 12 in 100,000 people. So just having the illness puts you at very serious risk. So we want to do everything we can to minimize that risk and treat the illness, not just because of the risk of suicide, but because depression really causes terrible pain and suffering and loss of function. I mean, it's a terrible illness, but a very treatable one.
How many young people, and I don't even know if we have figures, but you talk about since the late 1980s, we've had these drugs like Prozac and Zoloft. So a lot of people have been on them now, I would imagine, for a very long period of time.
Yes. Well, we know that the rates of the use of prescriptions in young people has steadily gone up over the last decade, double or tripled, in fact, since the 80s. And, you know, when people hear this, they think, oh, gosh, that's a lot of people getting medication. But at the same time, what's really interesting and important to note is during that same period, the rate of adolescent suicide has dropped. It's steadily dropped over the last decade. And obviously, you know, that's just an observation. And there's so many different factors in society and in the culture that might explain it. But one thing is that's consistent is that as the rates of the use of antidepressants in depressed adolescents has gone up, the rate of suicide has been going down steadily.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We don't test these drugs for long periods of time. You talk about part of the problem here is that to get FDA approval, they're tested for a relatively short period of time.
Right, right. In order to get the FDA approval to sell a drug on the market, drug companies basically all they need to do is two what's called randomized clinical trials where they give the drugs and compare the drug, the new drug, to a placebo in a group of people with a given illness like depression. And usually those trials, those studies last anywhere from, you know, 4 to 8 weeks, sometimes as long as 12 weeks. But that's a very short period of time compared to the actual, you know, time course that these drugs are used in the real world, which is years.
I am amazed, and you know, of course, better than I, but just from the number of people I know who are on antidepressants, there are a lot of people taking these drugs.
Yes, there are millions and millions of people who take these drugs every year. You know, if you think that the risk of depression in, let's say, the United States, the lifetime risk, meaning, you know, what is the chance that, you know, an American would have depression in their lifetime, you know, it's anywhere from 10 to 15% of the population.
Whew.
And that's a lot of Americans.
Why is that? Do we know?
Why is it so high?
Yeah.
You know, it's a very good question. The rates of depression, there's a so-called cohort effect, which we know has been happening for the last couple of decades, and that is the rates of depression seem to be going up. And so in every cohort, you know, whether you're born in 1960 or 70 or 80, each of those groups experiences increasing rates of depression. That is, that at any age you look, the rates of depression in each successive cohort is higher than the previous one. And, you know, there's all kinds of theories about why that is. It's not just in the United States. It's in other Western countries as well. And, you know, people look at social factors and stress and the roles that people play in society, but we don't really know, but it's an epidemiologic finding, and it seems very clear, and it's been replicated several times.
These drugs that you mention in your article, Prozac and Zoloft, why are they so prescribed? Are they very effective, and if so, for what reason? And are there new drugs emerging that are just as effective, if not more?
Well, Prozac and Zoloft, you know, are members of the so-called SSRIs, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors that came on the market in the late 80s. And these were the new drugs at that point. And the reason they became so widely prescribed is that they were generally more tolerable, easier to take, fewer side effects than the older drugs, but more importantly, they were safer. Because the older drugs, like the tricyclic antidepressants, that were used in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, those drugs had a lot of side effects, but in overdose, they were extremely, extremely toxic.
Mm.
Whereas the newer drugs were much safer. You know, a very big overdose of one of the newer drugs is not likely to seriously harm or even kill a person. So there was an advantage of safety. In terms of how effective they are, they're no more effective, meaning the same percent of people with depression will respond to the newer drugs as did with the older ones, but they're safer and they're more tolerable. So that's a big advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are lots of new drugs that are coming out that work in different mechanisms and different targets in the brain, and so we expect that their side effects will be different and maybe even their effectiveness will be different. Maybe they'll be more effective than the older drugs.
You talk about a young woman you were seeing, a patient in her mid-20s, and look at this in the context of other important issues to consider in the long-term use of depressants. She said that she felt like she always had a low sex drive, and her boyfriend wanted more sex than she wanted, and yet one of the side effects of the antidepressant she was taking was to lower libido.
Yes, yes. Well, I think the problem in that treatment was that previously when she was in treatment and reported low sex drive, it either didn't get discussed and didn't get explained to her that it's a side effect of the drug. You know, if she'd been an adult who took this drug after having a normal sex life, she would have recognized that, you know, the loss of interest in sex was not her, but the treatment. But she had no way to know this because she was treated from such an early age that her sexuality sort of developed under the cover of the antidepressant.
Mm-hmm.
So it needed to be explained to her.
And what other things may develop under the cover of the antidepressant that makes a person not really know who she or he is?
Well, it's more of a theoretical question at this point because we don't know. Mm-hmm. We assume and we know that depression is harmful to development in many ways, biologically and emotionally, because, for example, if you're depressed, you don't go out and make friends, you don't do things socially, you don't socialize in normal ways, and that has a huge effect on your development as a person. So you want to get rid of that as much as you can. On the other hand, what way does the drug have a direct effect on the development of the brain and, you know, a person's character or temperament? That's purely speculative. I'm just raising that question. No one really knows.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our lines were filled almost immediately, so there is a great deal of interest in this topic. Dr. Richard Friedman is our guest. He is professor of psychiatry and director of the Psychopharmacology Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. Our conversation prompted by an article that he wrote, a very interesting one, April 15, Science section of the New York Times, Who Are We? Coming of Age on Antidepressants. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to call us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. To you in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today is Earth Day. The second hour of our program, we'll be speaking with the author of Green, Greener, Greenest, a practical guide to making eco-smart choices a part of your life. Let's go to phone calls now for Dr. Richard Friedman, and we start our calls with Kathy from Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Bless you for doing this program. This means a lot to me. I have been on antidepressants off and on roughly for the last 15 years. I'm an adult, and there seems to be a family history of either substance abuse or depression. And I wonder sometimes if those of us with depression are just kind of the canaries in the coal mine in our culture. We have, in a lot of ways, it's a sick culture, and those of us on antidepressants are maybe just a little more sensitive to how screwed up it is. But anyway, the question I wanted to ask is, can you get off of them once you've been on them for a number of years? I seem to have the recurrent type of depression, and I'm told I'll be on this indefinitely. And I don't know how long is indefinitely.
Right. That's a great question. Well, I think that the answer is the way to think about depression is a chronic, recurring kind of problem, meaning you carry with you the vulnerability to get depressed. It doesn't mean that you're depressed all the time. It means usually that there's an interaction between, you know, your biological and genetic makeup and the environment of the world, the screwed-up world, as you call it. And so, you know, at certain points, the two interact and you can develop a clinical depression, and there may be other times where you can go long periods without it. Now, the answer to how long someone needs to be on an antidepressant is a very individual sort of decision, and it depends a lot on their history. So somebody who has many recurrences, many episodes of depression, especially when they're taken off the antidepressant, that usually means that they need to stay on antidepressants to remain well, in a similar way that, let's say, if you had hypertension. You stop the antihypertensive and your blood pressure just goes up to a place where it's not advantageous.
Right.
And so, you know, some people, when they stop antidepressants, remain well for long periods of time until and if they hit a life stressor that, you know, just hits them in the right way so that they develop a depression.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people's vulnerability to depression varies tremendously depending upon their genetic loading. So some people, as you know, can tolerate tremendous stress and, you know, very little seems to happen to them. And yet there are other people, even in the best environments with very little stress, loving families, who develop terrible depressions because presumably they have a much bigger genetic loading.
Mm-hmm. You said you've been off them at times, Kathy?
Well, as it goes, really, when my dad died in, I guess that was the spring of 93. In the fall of 93, I went through a terrible bout. And
yeah.
I have been on them ever since,
mm-hmm.
varying ones. Not the same one constantly, but I have been on a number of different ones.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
I understand completely.
Okay.
I understand completely.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Kathy. Thanks for the call. And what about this substance abuse, depression, the link between the two? If you have a family history of substance abuse, is there something in the genes that makes you more prone to depression?
And vice versa, looked at from both sides. So,
mm-hmm.
for example, we know that if you have a history of depression, you're much, much more likely to have a problem with alcohol and drugs. And, you know, the reasons are probably very complicated, and it may be because these two kinds of problems share a common factor in the brain in terms of vulnerability. It may also be that people who are depressed are basically medicating themselves with different substances in order to
mm-hmm.
make themselves feel better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, alcohol, which has some anti-anxiety effects acutely, although it's a terrible drug for depression because it makes people feel depressed down the line a few hours later. You know, people who are depressed will use stimulants in order to give themselves more energy, cocaine to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Again, terrible treatments for depression, but completely understandable because people want immediate relief. So it could be a self-medication phenomenon. And it may even be that these factors, like depression and substance use, actually are linked because they share a common factor in the brain.
We go next to Addie from Altoona. Hi, Addie.
Hi.
Hi.
This is a timely discussion for me also. I have a 17-year-old who is, well, last year to 2 years is going through hard teenage years. And I think it kind of started with him probably experiencing with marijuana. And so he's gotten anxious, he says, and somewhat depressed. So he went to a doctor, and the doctor on his first visit prescribed Lexotene, and as a teenager, I mean, every teenager, I think, at some point gets depressed, as well do people, but you go through those stages as a teenager, and I think you just have to, you know, go through it and realize what's making you depressed.
Mm.
But I think if you start taking, I'm very anti-pills.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't want him to start on these things because I just think he needs to get through it. Sorry.
Well, there's a good question. When are drugs appropriate and when not, Dr. Friedman?
Right. It's a great question.
Yeah.
Especially because, you know, if you think about young people, as, you know, you just said, I mean, it's normal for teenagers to have turmoil and to be tempestuous and have strong feelings. I mean, that's just part of adolescence. And it's not always so easy to tell the difference between, you know, the sort of depression where you have to step in and do something and really help the person professionally versus just normal ups and downs and turbulence of everyday teenage life. You know, one way to tell the difference, though, is, you know, if if the teen that you're talking about, you know, your son, basically is having trouble, you know, dealing with those feelings and it's getting in the way of his function, meaning schoolwork, friendships, socializing, and he or she is developing other sorts of symptoms like a problem with sleep, a problem with appetite, mm-hmm. or developing thoughts that are more worrisome, like, you know, gloomy thoughts and hopelessness and helplessness and the feeling like life isn't worth living and even suicidal thoughts, then you're sort of crossing the line from, you know, what's everyday unhappiness and turbulence into something that's more clinical and sounds more like a depression. And then the question isn't so much whether you've crossed that line. Then the question is what to do, because then it's not just everyday unhappiness. Then it's a clinical situation that really calls out for help. And the reason I'm making a point of it is the second cause of death in teenagers is suicide. And depression in teens and adolescents is an extremely serious problem, and you don't want to miss it.
Yeah.
Mm. So what have you done, Addie?
Well, one thing about what you just said is his social life seems to be very good, but his school and that kind of thing are not as he used to be, just a great student, and now all that is suffering quite a bit, and I think the sleeping and the eating too, because he tries really hard to just avoid mealtime, which with us, which I am very strong on too, and just everything. It's like family avoidance, but his social life seems to be quite good. But I don't know. He's got this one prescription, and I thought maybe we would just go through it, but I think he has started taking this other kind of anti-anxiety pill, which he's getting from somewhere, and that's another thing. I don't know if it's a thing with his friends and him. It starts with a C, and I know if you said it, I would know what it is, but that's a higher form of anti-anxiety pills, I think, and he says that it calms him down, and like if you were to smoke marijuana, which he said that he doesn't do anymore, but instead he's taking these anti-anxiety pills instead. So I'm not sure where to go with it.
Yeah, it's not so easy to tell just in one meeting with a teenager whether, you know, it's just turbulence of being a teenager or it's actually a depression. And, you know, it sounds like the best thing is to get really professional advice from a mental health professional.
Right.
And, you know, someone who's going to sit and spend some time and get to know him and find out, you know, how much of this is depression, how much of it is adjustment and reaction, because you don't want to just throw a medication at somebody. You really want to get to know exactly what's going on so that you can help determine which of these is really the problem.
Yeah. I feel for Addie. It's hard to be a parent under those circumstances.
Yeah.
It's hard to know how to make your son better. Thank you, Addie, very much for your call. We go to Mike from Appleton. Hi.
Yeah, good morning, Doctor. Good morning. My question is the following, and it relates to what you were saying before about the testing period for these drugs. The problem that I see is what comes first, the chicken or the egg, in the sense that a new drug is developed to combat, you know, whatever disease it may be. It's available, but, you know, how long do you test it? And if it's years worth of testing, then, you know, how many people went untreated or potentially had the possibility of being treated with that drug?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, on the one hand, we want drugs to be vigorously tested so that by the time they get to market, the public really feels assured that they're safe and they're effective. And actually, if you look at the FDA and the approval process, it's faster now than it's ever been. In fact, you know, one of the problems with the FDA is that it's underfunded to do what it's supposed to do, which is it can't possibly assure the safety and efficacy of every drug. It's just not there. They simply don't have the resources to do it. So while we want more and more medication, you know, the limit is the ability of the FDA actually to do this kind of work. And, you know, it will mean enormous increases in outlays for the FDA. So it takes time to go from the, you know, sort of basic lab to, you know, the clinical world where you actually get to test the drug. It's just, it's a slow process because you really have to be very careful.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, how long do you test a drug before you release it on the market? I mean, you could, they could come up with a drug today that, let's say, would cure, I don't know, let's say diabetes.
Uh-huh.
And you know, they do clinical tests, and it turns out that 30 years from now, it results that it was a bad drug, you know.
How do you know? okay. Well, the answer is that if the drug produces bad side effects, and the side effects that it produces are rare, you won't know the answer until many years, meaning many thousands of people have taken the drug, because typically the drugs are tested in maybe at most a few hundred people before they're released to market. And then there's post-marketing studies, but they're not systematic in the way that they are pre-marketing. So generally, you know, you discover that the drug, if it has bad side effects, and they're rare, meaning, you know, one in several million, or several hundred thousand, you're not going to be able to determine that from testing, because in order to do that, you'd have to do studies on several hundred thousand people, and that would be prohibitively expensive, and no one will be able to do such studies. So there is an inherent risk in the testing of drugs, but it's one where we weigh the risk against the benefits. We accept that there's a certain risk because the benefit is much larger than the risk. You know, it means that people with the disease are going to get treated early, and if the drug in 30 years produces a risk of 1 in a million, we as a society believe that that's a reasonable risk to assume because the benefit is so much larger than the risk.
It is interesting, you note in the article that the longest maintenance study to date of one of the newer antidepressants, is it Effexor?
Yes.
Lasted only 2 years, and it showed the drug to be superior to a placebo, but that's not a very long period of time.
Correct. You're absolutely right. We want to do these studies and have them go on for long periods of time, in part not just because we want to learn about the safety, but we want to see, you know, about the efficacy of a drug. When it comes to antidepressants, for example, the real test of a drug is not so much that it gets people better when they're acutely depressed, it's that it prevents them from ever getting sick again, because depression's a chronic disease.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Mike, for the call. One line is open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. 414-227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. Dr. Richard Friedman, professor of psychiatry and director of the psychopharmacology clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College, is our guest. And Erin from Milwaukee is our next call. Hi, Erin.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had a family history of depression, but, you know, from my experience, I still am on an antidepressant for the last 5 years. I was on Effexor XR for 4 years and just switched to a different one recently in the last year. But Effexor is what you just said about them not doing, you know, only doing 2 years of testing. I would recommend people not getting on it at all because it's so hard to get off of it. And I developed liver problems because of it. And then I got mono, and I think part of that has to do with, in my theory and from what I've read, and there's a Pfeiffer Clinic in Illinois that does nutritional therapy, and I was just wondering what you think about the theory of our diet and kind of, you know, deficiency of nutrients in our diet as being a theory for mental illness. And that's been my experience, and since I've started taking more vitamins and minerals and doing other things like, you know, essential fatty acids and bee pollen and everything, and B vitamins especially, and D vitamins, I've improved so much. So just wanted to get your comments.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, nutrition is one of those areas that we don't know a whole lot about because it's very hard to do systematic studies with nutrients because they're very complicated and because it's not clear that it's the nutrient or the actual combination of nutrients that are present in food that make people feel better. But one thing that seems very clear is that exercise has very strong antidepressant effects, and not just antidepressant effects, it seems very effective in anxiety problems. So, you know, eating a balanced diet and maintaining good nutrition and especially having regular exercise, no question that exercise is a powerful antidepressant with regard to the first thing you said, you know, some antidepressants actually are hard to get off of, especially those that are very potent and short-acting. And sometimes the way to do it is to do it very, very slowly. And even then, some antidepressants are well known to have discontinuation syndromes where people feel either emotionally more upset or physically out of sorts. And Effexor is one of those that has a more difficult discontinuation syndrome than any of the others.
I would think, too, if you've been on an antidepressant for a while and you're feeling better, that you would have great trepidation about going off it, and that psychologically you could say, I'm off the antidepressant, I don't feel good anymore.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, which is the way people link different events and circumstances in their life to how they feel. So your caller just said that, you know, she's been eating better and been taking nutrients and feels better and attributes her improved mood to the, you know, things that you've been doing in your diet. And I'm very happy that you're feeling better. But it's also possible that you're feeling better because you would be feeling better anyway. And, you know, the nature of mood and depression is such that it randomly changes over time. And, you know, these things just happen. And it's great that you're feeling better. But, you know, coincidences don't prove that things are related causally to one another.
Thank you very much, Erin, for your call. We go next to Teresa from Madison. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I wanted to comment to the previous caller whose son is anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And she probably already knows this, but I think it's really important for people to know that with anxiety, it's really important to have cognitive behavioral training because with anti-anxiety medications, there's an addictive quality, and studies also show that they don't really improve the person's ability to deal with anxiety over the long term. So when the drug wears off, they're not really better off. And with cognitive training, a person can learn to have a sense of control over their anxiety, unless it's, you know, a really extraordinary disorder. But for typical anxiety, I think it's important to know that some kind of training in therapy is very, very helpful.
Yeah, I think that's a critical point, which is a distinction between talk therapies and medication in general, that many talk therapies do give people a certain skill where they learn something. And when the therapy is over, they bring that skill with them, whereas when the medication stops, the benefit usually stops. You know, when it comes to depression, if the depression is more mild or moderate, talk therapy and medication are both equally effective. But when you're talking about much more severe depression, then the best treatment really is a combination of the two. And there are many people that won't get better with just psychotherapy alone, who have very severe forms of anxiety or severe forms of depression. But I agree with what you're saying. You know, if it's possible to learn certain skills about how to manage mood and anxiety with cognitive behavior therapy, that's terrific.
Thank you, Teresa, very much for the call. More phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour, as we talk about depression, he wrote an extremely interesting article in the New York Times, April 15, the Science section of the magazine, in which he recounted the story of a patient, Julie, who grew up on medication at the age of 31, had been on one antidepressant or another since she was 14, and it had really, she believes, saved her life. But now she was raising a question, how might the drugs have affected her psychological development and core identity? And it was an issue that the doctor started thinking long and hard about. The article also looks at what do we know about 15 to 20 years of antidepressant drug treatment that begins in adolescence or childhood? He looks at the way that drugs are tested and they are approved. And what does he say to a depressed patient who's doing well after 5 years on such a drug but can't stop without a depressive relapse and wants reassurance that the drug has no long-term side effects? Two lines are open right now, first time all hours, so if you've been trying to get through and you've been frustrated, we don't want you frustrated this hour. Call right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 866-414-227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. And we also have this email that you can use, and that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, it is Earth Day. We will talk with the author of Green, Greener, Greenest, a practical guide to making eco-smart choices a part of your life. Also big news today from Pennsylvania, it's the Pennsylvania primary, which we've been waiting a long time for. And tonight at 8 o'clock, you're invited to join us for special election coverage of this primary. NPR's Robert Siegel and Melissa Block will host a one-hour special covering the results from Pennsylvania and also then looking ahead to North Carolina and Indiana, which will take place in 2 weeks. Also, more analysis tomorrow morning at 7 with Joy Cardine. At 9 o'clock, we will analyze the Pennsylvania results with Sandra Van Oker, and Wednesday afternoon with Ben Marins at 4 o'clock on the Ideas Network. So lots of coverage of this tonight at 8, and then tomorrow at 7, 9, and 4. Back to your phone calls now, and let us go to Phyllis from Waupaca. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. I've had major clinical depression for over 25 years, and I went through a number of different medications, and I found that Prozac and Zoloft didn't help me at all. However, there are two medications that I feel are much better, and one is Celexa, and the other one is Lexapro. Currently, I'm taking Lexapro and also Buspar for anxiety. And the Lexapro and Buspar helped me a great deal. I didn't have problems with depression at home. However, I still had problems trying to attend church. And when we would get to prayer time, when we would pray for people that are in need, I would start to cry and have to leave. So that kept me from attending church regularly. And anyway, quite by accident, I read an article about how important vitamin D is, and they recommended taking at least 2,000 IUs of vitamin D every day. And so I started doing that, and to my pleasant surprise, after 2 months of taking 2,000 IUs of vitamin D every day, I could go to church again, and I have been attending church now for the last 3 months. And so I highly recommend people try taking 2,000 IUs of vitamin D if they want, for anybody. I heard Joy Cardine's show on vitamin D a while back, and it's extremely important for mental and physical health.
Dr. Friedman.
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating observation. Well, I'm glad that you are feeling better. You know, your own experience with these drugs, I think, very important for people to understand the point that you made in the beginning, which is that, you know, if you don't do well on one antidepressant, it doesn't at all mean that you won't respond and feel better on others, even members of the same family, because Zoloft and Prozac are in the same family with Lexapro and Celexa. And one thing that's important for listeners to know is that even though these drugs are in the same family, they are different enough from one another that you might respond to Prozac and not respond at all to Celexa, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. And this thing about vitamin D, we just don't get enough sunshine, right? I mean, you got to be careful of skin cancer, too. But I have heard that particularly in climates like ours, where it seems to be depressingly overcast and big snowstorms, et cetera, all the time, that you just don't get enough natural light.
Well, it's interesting. You know, sunlight definitely has antidepressant effects. It's believed because it basically has an effect on melatonin, which is a hormone that your brain secretes. It suppresses melatonin. But I'm not sure that it works or has any direct effect on vitamin D. But this is the second caller who mentioned nutrition and
right,
the importance of nutrition and mood.
Thanks, Phyllis, very much for the call. Yvonne from Brown Deer. Hi.
Good morning. A woman who said she'd been depressed for 25 years. I don't think this is a contest, but I stopped being depressed after 65 years. And I had been told that I was born with this depression in my brain. And when I was stopped being depressed was after I had had a number of multiple strokes plus a heart attack. I would like to talk to someone in the field, because doctors in other fields that I have see for skin things or whatever say they never heard of anyone's depression being cured by a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
But it was having a lifelong experience of it when I was recovering from the stroke. I was noticing weird things, like I kept hearing a woman's voice, and I didn't understand who it was. There were people coming in to help me at the time, and I never could figure out which of the women was doing this talking and singing. And after that episode was done, when I didn't have people around all the time, I finally realized that it was me talking and singing, and I was not depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, can I ever write zillions of stuff on how different it is to be somewhat normal.
Dr. Friedman.
That's a fascinating story. And actually, it is theoretically possible after a stroke to have a number of things happen. You know, some people after strokes get depressed. And, you know, we know that the circuitry in the brain, we know a lot about the relationship between different circuits in the brain and mood. And depending upon what kind of stroke you have, it's possible to get depressed after a stroke. It's also possible after a stroke for the opposite to happen.
Mm.
Some people get manic, the mirror image of depression after a stroke. So theoretically, I could imagine, depending upon where the stroke occurs in the brain, especially if it's in the front part of the brain, the so-called prefrontal cortex, that, you know, as a result of some of these circuits being interrupted by the stroke, it would certainly be possible that your mood could change. And this is one of those stories where, you know, something that potentially is a very sad thing turns into a very good thing. So it is possible.
Thanks, Yvonne, for your call. Susan from Middleton, hi.
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 I was wondering if the doctor would please comment on antidepressants and weight gain. It seems to me that they all cause weight gain with the possible exception of Wellbutrin. And I'd also like to know what happens when the patient goes off these medications in terms of the weight gain.
Thank you for the question. It's a big problem. In fact, it's not just weight gain, but there are side effects to all antidepressants. Weight gain is certainly among the top. But not just weight gain, but sexual side effects, decreased libido. Sometimes the weight gain is very severe, and people have to go off the antidepressant. Even if they try exercise and diet, they still, you know, have a problem with their weight. We don't understand why these drugs do it. Sometimes the drugs increase appetite, and people are aware that they're hungrier when they're taking the antidepressant, so they're eating more. And sometimes patients will say that they're not really eating more and they're really dieting, but they're still gaining weight, and it may be that the drugs are changing metabolism in some way. My experience is that often with exercise and diet, you can stem some of the weight gain from these drugs, and that when patients go off of them, they tend to lose weight, that it's not permanent. Again, it depends when in your life you're taking the antidepressant, because if you're taking the antidepressant as you're getting older and you've been on it for a long time and your metabolism naturally is slowing down, you will get off the antidepressant and find that it may not be so easy to lose the weight because your metabolism is slowed down from when you started the antidepressant. But the effect of the drug on your metabolism should stop once you stop the drug.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Susan, very much for the call. Laura from Superior, hi.
Hello, thanks so much for the topic. It's really helpful. I am 24, and I just was recently diagnosed with depression and anxiety. And so I just went on this medication. It was like a Celexa, but a generic brand. And immediately I had an allergic reaction. And so I'm kind of wondering where my options would be, because I haven't been able to meet with my doctor again. It's been 3 weeks, so it's kind of a setback, but like, is it possible that maybe I'm allergic to all SSRIs, or what would be my option if I wasn't allowed to go on another SSRI?
Can I ask you what you mean by an allergic reaction?
Yeah, I had like a phase rash, diarrhea, a harder time sleeping than I already was having.
You had a rash?
A rash, yeah, on my face immediately.
So, yeah, if you have an allergic reaction to one, you certainly needn't have it to others. There's sometimes the allergic reaction is to an ingredient in the pill that's not the active ingredient, but some of the dye that's used in the pill and other substances. And even if that's the case, you may not have an allergic reaction to any member of the same family.
Mm.
So it doesn't mean at all that your options are limited. It means you probably shouldn't take this drug again is Celexa.
And it means you need to see your doctor, right? Can you get in soon?
Yeah, I hope so. I have an appointment on the 30th, but it's been 3 weeks. And when you have depression and you're finally just getting into,
right,
you know, getting help, it's just so frustrating.
Right.
But thank you so much for having this topic.
Yes, you're welcome. Thanks so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
We go to Carol from Janesville next. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call and having this subject. I was on Lexapro. And I think that all the antidepressant and anti-anxiety medications are wonderful when you need it. But after being on the medication, and I didn't notice much of a change, but my husband did. And when he brought it to my attention and I got thinking about it, I'm like, you know, you're right. And I had talked with my doctor and, you know, got weaned off the medication. Well, now that I'm off of it, and I agree with, I don't know if it was your guest or a speaker that had talked about the cognitive thinking, and that is a huge plus. My daughter is on the same medication now for the last few years, and we've noticed a difference, a great difference in her, and it's similar to what I went through. And my husband said after being on the medication that I just became emotionless. I flatlined.
Hmm.
And now that my daughter is going through counseling and seeing a doctor about this, I would like to call the doctor, and I would like to let them know. But a lot of times they won't let you talk to them. They won't let you get any information because of the confidentiality laws.
Right.
And it's very, very frustrating. And I wanted to make a comment on that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the experience you had on the antidepressant where you felt that the drug made you not just feel better from depression, but made you feel emotionally flattened. Many people who take these drugs report a similar kind of experience after their depression clears up. And, you know, it's been reported that one of the effects can be a kind of an emotional flattening over time. And it may mean that the dose of the medicine needs to be adjusted because those effects are reversible. And if you stop the medicine or you go on a different medicine, you know, your emotional reactivity and your response should come back. And as for the question of communicating with your daughter's clinician or psychiatrist, you know, with her permission, there really shouldn't be a problem. She just needs to give consent. I'm assuming she's an adult. For her therapist to speak with you, or you can just write a note or, you know, give her something in writing to express your concern to communicate with him. But I don't see that there should be a problem if she's given consent for you to do so.
Yes.
To give consent. And we've told our daughter, we've noticed that, you know, you don't even seem to be getting sad. You don't seem overjoyous like you used to be, even being on the medication. And I was told the same thing about being on it, that, you know, let's up the dose. And I said, no, I want to get off of this, and I did with their help, and now I'm feeling fine. I feel more normal now than I did being on it. I needed it in a time in my life when I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
But being on it for so long, and then that's it, and I know everyone's different,
mm-hmm.
But I'm seeing the same pattern with my daughter now, and I just wish that there was something I could do as far as, you know, if I can get her to sign the paper so I can talk with the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your call. Let's go next to Anne from Milwaukee. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to ask the doctor about safety during pregnancy of taking these antidepressants.
Mm-hmm. It depends on which drug and which class. You know, there's no such thing as a drug which is approved for use in pregnancy. And there's some drugs, you know, that we know more information about, in terms of their effects. In general, the drugs in the family with Prozac, the SSRIs, are considered safe in pregnancy. There don't seem to be any risks to the fetus in terms of problems in development of the organs anything of that kind. And again, you're weighing the risks and the benefits. In somebody who has very bad depression, being depressed during pregnancy is also harmful, potentially harmful to the fetus, in the sense that depressed mothers may not take the best care, may not get the best nutrition, etc. So not taking a medicine, if it means that you're depressed during pregnancy, also presents risks to the fetus. In general, the drugs in the family with Prozac are considered safe in pregnancy. And it really has to be, the answer is you have to look at each drug separately and look at all the information which is known about that drug.
And thank you very much for the call. Oh, this hour just went by so quickly. So many people interested in and in need of the topic. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Friedman.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Our guest this hour, Dr. Richard Friedman. He's a professor of clinical psychiatry and director of the psychopharmacology clinic at Cornell, specializes in anxiety and mood disorders, and also his expertise is in psychopharmacology and refractory depression. He writes frequently for the New York Times science section, where he writes on behavioral science. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and for all of your insightful calls. As always, thank you. News ahead will return on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.